News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Good evening and thanks for joining us. On today's show, we'll take a look at the relationship between economics and social environmental justice. How does income reflect your carbon footprint? In an interview with Mark Lee from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, reporter Andrew Longhurst brings us an engaging examination of how economics can be used to address climate change and other causes. Also on today's show, we'll have an interview with Hunter Moyes of the Vancouver People's Summit. With the 36th G8 Summit taking place in Ontario at the end of June, organizations, collectives, coalitions, and groups across the world are gearing up to have their voices heard. The Vancouver People's Summit aims to build bridges between diverse communities in order to send a strong, united message to our world leaders. Organized in partnership with Car Free Day, an event that CITR is proud to sponsor, the summit will take place on the ground on June 20th between 30th and 33rd Avenues on Main Street. Mr. Moyes will be joining us later in the show to discuss what's going on with this collaborative event. We'll also have this, as well as our weekly feature with Colleen Kimmett from the TAI, in our second of many future collaborations. She joins us over the phone to chat about some recent stories published on the TAI.ca, the independent daily online magazine. That's all on today's broadcast for May 24th here on News 101, your source for community and campus news, and broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in a now sunny Vancouver. But to start things off, here are today's headlines from the Free Speech Radio News.
Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court today agreed to consider the civil rights of death row inmates with respect to DNA testing of evidence. In a case that may have broad implications, the court will consider the possibility that federal civil rights law may allow Henry Skinner to gain access to DNA testing of evidence that was not done during his trial, but that may well exonerate him of the 1993 Texas murder of his girlfriend and her two children. In the past, the court has said that convicted criminals do not have the right to demand DNA testing, but this is the first case that considers a death row inmate trying to save his life. For the second week in a row, arrests in New York City call attention to comprehensive immigration reform. FSRN's Renee Feltz has more.
Last Monday, 16 people calling for immigration reform were arrested for blocking a busy street in front of New York City's Federal Plaza. That number more than doubled today when 37 people were handcuffed and loaded into a police van. They included members of New York City Council, State Assembly, as well as union leaders and clergy members.
We believe immigration is a civil rights issue of the 21st century.
Bishop Orlando Finlater was among those arrested. He's the leader of a coalition of 140 Caribbean churches that have undocumented immigrants in their congregations.
We have written letters, we have marched, we have rallied, and we have seen no real action. And so it's our intention to step up.
Renee Feltz, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Violence spread in Jamaica today, where heavily armed police patrolled the streets of Kingston and locals blocked a bridge that links the capital city with Montego Bay. Unrest began last week after Jamaica agreed to extradite an alleged drug kingpin. But Christopher Koch's supporters say he's a legitimate businessman and have taken up arms to defend him. Today, Koch said he would not surrender. Two police officers are dead, at least six others injured. A state of emergency was imposed last night. According to U.S. Drug Enforcement officials, Koch is accused of running a violent gang called the Shower Posse that sells drugs in the U.S. and sends him the profits. A U.N.-sponsored summer camp in Gaza was set ablaze today following warnings over the weekend from imams. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
The blaze completely devastated one of the summer camps the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, is setting up in Gaza. Over the weekend, imams at various Gaza mosques warned that the UN agency's co-ed camps create values that contradict the conservative nature of Gaza society by bringing both boys and girls together. Local community groups say the fire will affect the children's summer activities just at a time the kids of Gaza need such recreational programs. They call on the Hamas-led government to immediately bring to justice those behind the attack. For the second year in a row, the UNRWA is organizing summer programs in many parts of the region. They hope to provide the kids in Gaza an opportunity to find fun again after the violence of the January 2009 Israeli incursion. The project covers all elementary and preparatory UN-run schools. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Japan, at least 70 detainees in the Yoshiku Immigration Detention Center northeast of Tokyo have been on hunger strike for more than 13 days. FSRN's Claudia Craig has more.
The hunger strikers, many of them Sri Lankans and Pakistanis, are refugees who came to Japan looking for work. Apart from the unexplained death of an African inmate, they also want to bring to the world's attention the suicides in the center of a Brazilian and South Korean detainee. Back in March, Jorge Bustamante, a UN human rights envoy, raised serious concerns about Japan's often years-long detentions of undocumented migrants, including parents with children, as well as rejected asylum seekers. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
Also from Japan, Prime Minister Yukio Hatoyama did an about-face and said due to the political climate in the Koreas, he's decided to make good on an agreement with the U.S. and move the Futenma Air Force Base to another location on the island. South Korea officially cut trade ties with the North today and banned Pyongyang's ships from South Korean waters. The moves come as a result of the sinking of a South Korean warship. 46 sailors were killed. Both the U.S. and the U.N. expressed support for South Korea. And in Chicago, proceedings began in the trial of a former police officer accused of covering up past torture of suspects. Lieutenant John Burge has pleaded not guilty to obstruction of justice and perjury during a civil trial on charges that he was responsible for torturing suspects throughout the 1970s and 80s. He's not charged with torture because the statute of limitations has run out. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Those were our headlines for Monday, May 24th from Free Speech Radio News, and as always, we thank them for that. We're going to take a quick 30-second break, but when we come back, we have Colleen Kimmett from the TAI to talk about some recent headlines from their online magazine.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
The Seed Productions Foundation is proud to present An Evening with Deepak Chopra. On the heels of two new releases, the New York Times best-selling author Deepak Chopra will bring his message of well-being to Vancouver on June the 4th. Dr. Chopra is acknowledged as one of the world's leaders in mind-body medicine and has been described as the poet-prophet of alternative medicine. He will talk about his latest works, Reinventing the Body, Resurrecting the Soul, How to Create a New You, and The Ultimate Happiness Prescription, The Seven Keys to Joy and Enlightenment. An Evening with Deepak Chopra at the Queen Elizabeth Theater, Friday, June 4th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets online at Ticketmaster.ca.
And when you experience that, you'll be extremely ecstatic. You'll be extremely joyful because this is the real you. And that equals nirvana.
You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, and we've just had some headlines from FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, and we turn now to headlines from a more local source. The Tyee's Colleen Kimmett joins me over the phone to talk about some of the most recently published articles from the independent online magazine. Thanks for joining us, Colleen.
You're welcome. I'm calling from Lytton, actually. I was hiking in the Stein Valley this weekend, and I thought I'd be back in Vancouver by now, but I'm not. So if you hear a train whistle or some traffic, that's because I'm at a payphone on Lytton's main street.
Well, it's quite romantic to think that you're speaking to us from there. To start things off, last Monday you started telling us a little bit about smart grids and smart meters. You described it as a layer of intelligence put onto an electricity grid that allows for two-way communication between the grid, the utility, and the user. But I believe you were working on a story about how these smart grids were being developed, and you gave us a great deal as to their technological prowess. Now, earlier this week, you posted another story on the Tyee.ca about these smart grids, and you asked, is BC ready for smart meters? So, Colleen, I have to bite. Is BC ready?
Well, we are behind the U.S. That's sort of the message I got from a lot of the sources I interviewed for this story. The message really was, and this story kind of had a business angle. You know, I was talking to the tech companies that actually build smart meters or smart meter technology or smart grid-related technology, and they're saying that without a doubt, smart meters are coming, but there's a couple areas where we're behind. The first is in developing some standards around smart meters, because there are some concerns about, you know, smart meters are hooked into a network, so the utility is able to access information about a residential user's energy use via computer. So there's concerns about who is able to hack into these networks and what information would be available to them, to the utility, to other users. And the U.S. Is developing some standards and has been for a while, and Canada is just sort of getting around to that now. Just a couple of months ago, the Standards Council of Canada launched a task force looking at some of these privacy and security questions around smart meters.
So this was, to my understanding, this was a report that you'd filed thanks to some funding from the Tyee as well as others. And so it's the second in this series, I believe. Can we expect more? Will you hope to address this issue in further detail?
Well, on smart meters, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's lots of layers here, and I definitely want to get at this. Rolling out next in this series, though, it's a fairly broad-looking series, so we do want to look at other aspects of clean technology. One journalist who works often with the Tyee is Chris Poland, is working on a story about electric vehicles and a company in Vancouver that's actually retrofitting vehicles, so they install, turn a regular car, gas-guzzling car, into an electric vehicle. So Not sure if there'll be any more smart meter stories in this series, but it's definitely something I want to pursue, and you'll see more of on the Tyee, I'm sure.
Well, and as I'm sure most of our listeners are aware, the Tyee is one of the great sources for that type of independent coverage of what's going on with the environment and with power in Canada. So speaking with, keeping with the theme of energy and energy production, can you tell us a little bit about an article that Andrew McLeod recently published on the Tyee? Always an interesting topic. Can you tell us whether or not there is potential for some high-level government intrigue with BC Hydro's Clean Power Calls supposedly independent observer?
Yeah, well, in the legislature last week, the NDP energy critic John Horgan raised questions about the fairness of BC Hydro's clean energy call, because John Singleton, a lawyer who was selected as the independent observer to oversee BC Hydro's clean power call, turns out has done some work for BC Hydro in the past. Between 2001 and 2009, Horgan pointed out, he was paid $2.5 million. And John Singleton donated $1,000 to the BC Liberals in 2009, and his law firm, Singleton Urquhart, donated $5,000 in 2009 to the BC Liberals. And I wanted to talk about this story because it's it drew comparisons to the Kashid campaign investigation, where the special prosecutor who was assigned to look into allegations of breaking the Elections Act withdrew after revealing that he had also donated to Heed's campaign. And at the end of this month, a six-member task force that was assigned to look at finance reform in the elections is going to issue their first report. So it'll be interesting to see what that task force comes up with. Things they're looking at are these very issues: campaign finance, contribution limits, spending limits. So that comes out in a month, and we'll be watching for what they say.
Well, I'm sure that we'll all be tuning into the Tyee to find out this really interesting, I don't want to say meme, but really interesting what's going on in BC and Canadian politics. Jumping lastly to a story that resonates quite loudly at CITR, and I'm sure resonates quite loudly with those who support the Tyee, Alfred Hermida recently wrote about local news in Canada. Can you tell us a little about Mr. Hermida's report on journalism in Canada?
Yeah, this was a story we republished from a new media blog on PBS.org called Media Shift. It's about how a fallen print empire, that's CanWest, and a new media startup called OpenFile.ca are banking on an appetite for local coverage. So CanWest, some background here for your listeners who don't know, was bought for $1.1 billion, big buyout, by a veteran news executive named Paul Godfrey. So what he got was 46 dailies and weeklies, Canada.com, and the National Post. And right now, digital media is less than 10% of CanWest's revenue, and Paul Godfrey wants to increase that to 25%, and he's going to try and take a local approach, he says, by trying to build up local websites and websites affiliated with Canada.com to provide local news, which is, we've got even the Tyee were provincial, but I think there is definitely a need and hopefully an appetite for digital media that is, like a local newspaper.
And that's quite interesting in terms of the new venture startup out of Toronto, the one that's a bit more user-generated. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, OpenFile.ca launched on May 11th. And it's backed by several million dollars in venture capital, and it's headed by former CBC and CNN journalist named Wilf Dinell. And they call it Open File because they see it. They're not publishing stories because
you know, what they publish can evolve and change depending on what users send in or want to add for it, or, you know, if they want to call in news tips, that sort of thing. So they see the story, the digital story, news story, as not, you know, a finished story. It's something that keeps evolving.
So obviously this is very important, and we can't, you know, get into too much detail here. And so if people do want to check out Mr. Humida's article, they can get it on that PBS website or the Thai. But before I let you go, Colleen, I was hoping that you could tell us your opinion. How do these new ventures, how will they fare with an ongoing and disheartening decrease in print culture? And what do they mean for places like CITR News and for the Thai.ca?
Well, I think that... I think that one positive that's happening, I mean, whether these sites survive past the, you know, first 3 years is I'm not sure. I wish I knew. I can't read the future. But I think whether, you know, these new startup sites survive or not, what they're building is a community of digital journalism. And, I mean, for example, the story we published, you know, we republished that from PBS.org, and I see a lot more of that co-opetition between new media outlets. They're willing to share content in order to, you know, spread that great content and also maybe fill out their coverage.
Well, I'm afraid that I'm going to have to let you go. We can definitely hear the traffic in Lytton, and so I don't want to keep you any longer than we have to. But I look forward to hearing from you in 1 week's time, and maybe we could pick up some of this dialogue about media democracy and new media on this coming Monday's show. So thanks again for speaking with us today, Colleen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Colleen Kimmett from the Thai.ca. And for more on smart grids, local news, and what's happening with BC Hydro, go to the Thai.ca. That's Thetyee.ca. We're going to take a quick break, but in roughly 2 minutes and 30 seconds, we will have Hunter Moyes, organizer of the Vancouver People's Summit, on the phone. He'll be on to tell us how serving members of Amnesty International a whole meal and members of Oxfam International only rice will foster creativity in order to address some global challenges this June. That's right here on News 101, your home for local and international news on the community radio station CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces. All in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. And I want to thank you all very much for being with us. As part of our summer, we like to introduce our listeners to some great local talent and some people who are making just some great music here in Vancouver. So for now, we have a track off of the album Nice, Nice, Very Nice by the artist Dan Mangan. So get ready for Road Regrets.
Drive until the gas is gone, and then walk until our feet are torn. Crawl until we feed the soil. Film the whole thing. It's all business in the left hand lane. Drive there and then drive back again. Escape can't be the only way to So I've gotten used to coffee sweat. Still getting used to road regret. The hell, I took you up on all your threats to leave. It's a shame. It's a crying shame. Them's the brakes. Likes his country tunes. It's never been the lens that I see through. But I guess driving for a week or two puts words in your mouth. So find Dodge and then get out of it. It's about as country as I get. So you ain't living till you're living it. Not dead till you die. But watch out for the paraphrase. Cause they will crown you and they will take your life. The brakes, and ain't it always the way that takes you back to from where it is you came? It's a shame, it's a crying shame. Them's the brakes, and ain't it always.
That was Road Regrets, Dan Megan's song off of the album Nice, Nice, Very Nice. And we are back in the studio. This is News 101. I'm Bradley Pepping, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Local activist and famed Prince of Pot Mark Emery pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Seattle today to conspiracy to manufacture marijuana. Emery was extradited last week and will be sentenced in August, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. He'll remain at the detention center at SeaTac in Washington until the sentencing. In the plea agreement, Emery admits that he and his co-conspirators operated a marijuana seed distribution that sold marijuana seeds to customers throughout the U.S. Emery could face 5 years in prison. In more local news, six people were arrested Saturday when the Vancouver police met with protesters near the Fairmont Hotel. According to the Vancouver Observer, a group of about 100 people had marched from the Vancouver Art Gallery to the Fairmont Hotel to protest the G8 University Summit. The G8 Summit, taking place in Ontario at the end of June, is a meeting of heads of state to discuss world policy. The third G8 University Summit, taking place for the first time in North America this past Saturday at the Fairmont Hotel in downtown Vancouver, aimed, quote, to make international contributions representing academia in order to achieve the sustainability of the global, social, and human systems, and their mutual relationships and to promote education for sustainable development and construction of an international network through cooperation among universities, end quote. However, according to activist Harsha Walia, who spoke with Linda Solomon of the Vancouver Observer, quote, when you break down the summit, it's knocking out a path of neoliberalism and inaccessibility to pursue education, end quote. The protest ended with three men and three women taken away by police and a Vancouver Police Service press release stating that police equipment was damaged. Most shocking in the VPS press release was the mention that no injuries were reported. However, according to Harsha Walia, the police were dragging people through the streets after the protesters circled a bus full of delegates. Ms. Walia also reported receiving a concussion that was treated at the hospital, suffered after being thrown to the ground multiple times by the Vancouver police. In her article, Linda Solomon points out that most major news outlets in Canada reported on the event without actually covering it. Instead of speaking to activists, the CBC, the province, and others simply offered their readers the VPS release, says Solomon. For a more comprehensive look at this week's protest and to hear what Linda Solomon had to say about it, please check out her article on the Vancouver Observer webpage. In more G8-related news, I'm now joined on the phone with Hunter Moyes from the Vancouver People's Summit. And thank you so much for joining me, Mr. Moyes.
You're very welcome, Bradley. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the Vancouver People's Summit, as I said in the introduction to today's show, is scheduled for June 20th and is taking place in the midst of the Main Street Car-Free Day Festival. So the summit aims to bring together different communities, different cultural and activist communities in order to create a dialogue in which people can engage with to target issues about the G8. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And
Number one, I guess our relationship with Car Free Day is a great one. It's a very new thing this year. It seemed like a natural fit. I guess the core values of what we've got going on jive perfectly with the core values of what Car Free Day represents. And yeah, you're absolutely correct to say that there are a lot of different communities that are joining powers to make this a great event. And I could go on. You have questions, though?
I do have questions, but first let's actually go over. So to my understanding, there are going to be three main themes or three issues in which that you hope to address. And so those are poverty and inequality, climate change, and the global economy. And so those are being catered to specific groups who are taking part in this activity. Is that right? I know Oxfam International and Amnesty International are taking part, but are there other groups kind of aligned to those types of ideas?
Absolutely. What we're doing is creating three mini summits, so to speak. At these summits, there will be some very high-level representatives from some of the organizations that you mentioned, as well as some others, including the David Suzuki Foundation, Engineers Without Borders, Fair Trade Vancouver. We're in talks with Greenpeace right now. There is actually some international cooperation. We're getting 350 to do some of our media. There's a Vancouver People Summit, but there's also a Toronto People Summit. These are basically community-level exercises that are linking people close to decision-making, as in people high up in these non-government organizations, and interested members of the public, who you could say, I suppose, are closer to the effects of the decision-making. It's an exercise, I suppose, to foster a relationship between those two levels of thought, I suppose, in community.
And so I think this is a really interesting thing in terms of bringing it back to what happened on Saturday. A lot of the protesters were saying that they just wanted to break down the barriers and allow for more students to enter into these conversations with university administrators. And so the opportunity for you to have the Vancouver People's Summit in participating in Car Free Day, it will allow that opportunity for people just on the streets to connect with these types of policy-making decisions. Is that what you're hoping to accomplish on June 20th?
What we're hoping to do, I suppose, is it's a very interesting time in the scene here. At the highest levels, everybody's kind of discussing what's working and what's not. Clearly, there are a lot of classic approaches that just are not getting any traction these days. So, again, what we're trying to do is create a very, very positive environment and a new approach, I suppose, to dialogue on these issues. As far as the general public is concerned, we are inviting as many people to come and take interest and to get involved on the day of. But really, we've got an RSVP system going through our website. So we are opening our talks to members of the public, but they have to apply through the website, basically stating what their interest in the exercise is and what they want to bring to the table. This is a very inclusive event. Nothing about this is exclusive, and we're inviting as many people as possible to participate. But on the day of, in order to make things as productive as possible, we're not going to open up, I suppose, these forums to the general public, because we are expecting thousands of people.
Right. And so maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you're hoping will happen after the summit. To my understanding, you're hoping that maybe some of the delegates will ride from Vancouver to Toronto to the G8 summit?
Well, there's a lot of talk, I guess, across the country right now, collaboration between the Toronto People's Summit and the Vancouver People's Summit. As of right now, nothing is nailed down in concrete. What we hope, really, is there are two main things. Number one is that we can popularize this sort of exercise, because not enough people are involved. Not enough people are taking interest in this sort of exercise, because in some parts it's still seen as a taboo type of thing. But I guess really it's the youth engagement movement and the general engagement movement, because really we do need more people off the fence and in and involved with these sort of events. But number two, we are hoping that the gray matter that we are kind of bringing together for these tables, it's going to be capable of making some very, very impactful, suggestions towards the leaders, our representatives, our Canadian representatives, to take to the tables of the G8 summit. We really are hoping to, what we should be doing is leveraging our representatives and providing the feedback that we should, have a right to.
And so one of the great unfortunate things about our radio program is that we can't go too in-depth into these issues. And so I wish that we could talk about these things, because it is fascinating. But if our listeners are interested, you mentioned a website. Where could people find out more information about what you're doing?
Absolutely, and thanks for asking. It's quite simple. It's VancouverPeoplesSummit.ca, two S's, so People Summit. But you can access us by Google. We've got all forms of social media going, the Facebook, the Twitter. There are a lot of ways to get involved. So type that in, and you'll be directed appropriately.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on our show, Hunter, and I really do look forward to seeing you down there on June 20th for Car Free Day on Main Street.
Right on. Thank you very much, Bradley. It was a pleasure.
And that was Hunter Moyes of the Vancouver People's Summit speaking to us about what they're going to be doing in preparation for the G8 summit. When I face a challenge, it is so often directly related to money, and in reality, so many of our concerns are directly related to economics. In an interview with Mark Lee from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives earlier today, Andrew Longhurst spoke about how money and economics factor into how we approach social and environmental justice. Here's that conversation Andrew had with Mark Lee.
Can you first start out by telling me a little bit about your background? And I understand you were trained classically in economics, and how you've come to the place you are in looking at economics from more of a progressive social and environmental justice side.
Yeah, well, I studied economics and was always interested in that field from when I was younger, and studied through a bachelor's and master's degrees at university. I think around the late 80s, early 90s, I became very interested in environmental issues. And so one of the topics that I took up in my master's degree was around ecological economics, and just trying to get an understanding of that. Because, economics generally in the mainstream doesn't really have a whole lot to say about the environment, about the sources of energy and materials that go into the goods and services that we consume, or the waste that gets produced out of that. So that was a real eye-opener for me in terms of my thinking. But then I went off on totally different directions. So I was looking at technology policy and information and communication technologies, worked for the federal government for a few years doing that, and then came back to BC and eventually found work with the CCPA, and there I've been mostly looking at federal and provincial budget issues and taxation and public finance as it relates to healthcare and education and poverty and inequality and a whole bunch of related issues. So it was only just in the past few years that I was able to bring all of these things back together into what we call climate justice, which is looking at the social justice or equity and fairness challenges that we face in making a fairly massive industrial revolution in terms of how we transform to a sustainable economy. So I take a lot of satisfaction in that, in terms of going back to the kind of the environmental roots and trying to use my economics in sort of an innovative way there.
Now, tell me a little bit about the Climate Justice Project. Obviously, this is something that you're very involved in. And what are the goals of the Climate Justice Project?
Well, the Climate Justice Project, it's a multi-year initiative led by the CCPA, partnered with the University of British Columbia. And we have a fairly large team of academics from UBC and the other universities in BC, and a wide range of NGO partners, the main environmental NGOs, labor unions, anti-poverty groups, and several others. And the intent is really to sort of talk about the other inconvenient truth of our time, not just climate change, but rising inequality, and linking those two together, and to try to think about what does a sort of coherent policy strategy for British Columbia as a case study look like in terms of fairly aggressive reductions in our greenhouse gas emissions, but trying to identify the justice or equity issues that emerge in that type of transition and to design policies in a way that are ultimately just and equitable.
Well, and that social justice side is definitely explored in the recent report by our own emissions. Can you talk a bit about that report that just was released?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even really a report. It's more of a short brief, and it was just designed to put some information in the public domain about the distribution of greenhouse gas emissions in BC. So, typically when we see reporting about greenhouse gas emissions, they're broken down by the residential sector or commercial buildings and different types of industry. And what I was interested in was to sort of say, well, not everyone has the same footprint when it comes to carbon emissions. And the CCPA had done a study a couple years ago looking at the concept of the ecological footprint by income group. So they broke them into groups of 10% from the lowest to the highest income, and found, as what people might expect, that the families with the highest incomes had far and away the largest ecological footprint. So I wanted, with this study, was just to do a bit of a baseline around greenhouse gas emissions for different types of families. When you look more specifically just at the amount of fuel that you use in your house for heating or in your vehicles for transportation, and then what are sort of called these sort of indirect emissions that by virtue of consumption embodied in the goods and services that we consume are a whole bunch of industrial emissions, some of which are here in BC and some of which are in countries like China or the United States where those goods are manufactured.
Now, were there any surprises after working on this brief?
Well, I mean, it's similar to the ecological footprint. You find that the lowest income families have the lowest emissions per person. On average, it's about 10 tons of carbon dioxide per person. It's a little bit sort of, an awkward thing to talk about, because I don't think, carbon dioxide's invisible and people don't normally think about tons of carbon dioxide in their day-to-day lives. But, on average for British Columbia, it's about 10 tons per person. For the bottom 20% of households, it's more like 7 per person. So, it's already 30% less than the average. And then for the top quintile, or the top 20%, it's about 13 tons per person. So what you find is in the top 20%, it actually has a carbon footprint that's double that of the bottom 20%. And if you went further and further up the income distribution, if you could break it out into the top 5% or the top 1%, you would find that pattern sort of continue ever upward.
Now, is the goal for people in higher income brackets, is the goal to present this information in a way that they realize that this is not an equitable way to to be living, or is more of the goal to point this out and maybe other people see this injustice? Are you going to convert people? I mean, are people that have a higher, are you know, releasing higher amounts of emissions in their day-to-day activities, are they going to suddenly change their lifestyle?
Well, I hope that people are inclined to change their lifestyle. I mean, I do think that over the longer term, you know, what really changes the emissions profile is the structural context within which people live. So it's not necessarily about someone saying, oh, you know, the right thing for me to do would be to take the bus today or bike to work today. It's that instead they live in a place where they could walk or bike to work much more easily, or the services they need, whether they're public services or, you know, retail outlets, or even parks and other amenities, are within sort of walking and biking distance, so that they make the right decision because it's simply it's a no-brainer. It's obvious for them to do it, rather than having to sort of buy in to kind of a green philosophy in terms of how they think about things. And, you know, it's not about them sacrificing and taking longer to get to work, or, you know, paying more for certain types of goods and services, although that may, you know, be part of it. You know, it is ultimately changing the way in which we sort of live, work, and play. So that takes a long time. That's the project over several decades. But I think what we're trying to do in the here and now is to sort of just say, well, you know, here's what emissions look like by different types of income groupings, and to say, well, you know, if we have greenhouse gas reduction targets, like we do in BC through legislation, what is a fair way of achieving those targets? And there are different conceptions of fairness that come up when you look at the literature. So, for example, one way of viewing that would just to say that every household from its own starting point should reduce their emissions by a third. And another way would be to say, well, actually, you know, by 2020, when we need to meet that one-third reduction, every family or every individual should have the same amount of emissions that they are allowed to emit, and that is more consistent with fairness. So part of the paper was to just model what those two different scenarios would look like based on you know, both of which could be considered fair depending on different perspectives, but actually have very radically different implications for you know, who has the burden.
Do you think inherently when we look at climate justice as an issue, we have to look at it from the angle of class?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be class, although, you know, my organization tends to think about social justice a lot in terms of those general class issues, but it could also be along racial lines or gender lines. I think some of the really challenging issues, you know, worldwide have to do with kind of rich countries like Canada and poor countries, and the idea that, you know, in Canada and the United States and Europe, for generations, we have been emitting large amounts of greenhouse gases, and we've almost sort of claimed a fairly large chunk of the global commons for our own development, and that is now precluding the ability to develop along a similar path in a lot of poor countries in the world. So there's a fundamental sort of international justice issue there as well.
So I want to ask you two questions. First, do you think the provincial government or, you know, the federal government is looking at climate justice and the connection between environmental justice and social justice in some of the ways that the CCPA does and the Climate Justice Project does? And secondly, is the field of economics addressing the issue of climate change better than it has in the past? Are there ways to address it that, 'cause for a long time, you know, economics has been seen as not able to address environmental issues in a way that really fully addresses the issue in a way that it needs to be addressed?
Well, let me take the first one on first, around the, you know, provincial government. I think what our Climate Justice Project is doing is actually thinking about how the interaction between, you know, climate action and social justice plays out, and to articulate how government should redesign or rethink policies in accordance with that. I think we, you know, had some success. For example, when the carbon tax got introduced, they brought in a low-income credit to sort of make sure that the lowest-income families in BC weren't disproportionately affected by the tax. And we kind of crunched the numbers on that in 2008. And, you know, at least in the first year, on average, the bottom 40% of households got more back in low-income credits and tax cuts than they paid in the tax. Now, what's happened is 2 years down the road, the taxes, you know, will have doubled as of July, but the low-income credit will have only increased by about 5%. So that means that the overall regime in terms of the tax itself and the recycling aspect of it, the spending measures of what you do with those tax revenues, is going to become regressive for low-income families. So we think that's a problem. I think, you know, the government's instincts were right when they brought in the tax in the first place, but they've been slow to ramp up the low-income credit in line with the carbon tax itself. So that's something we'll be pushing on this fall as we head into the next budget.
And is it important to look at a cap-and-trade system as well, coupling these two things together?
Well, yeah, I mean, cap-and-trade and carbon tax are, you know, in stylized, you know, forms are different ways of getting at the same problem. I think probably politics is going to drive this particular bus, and if we do see a cap-and-trade system emerging out of the U.S. Congress, and there's some signs that, you know, they may be getting close to something along those lines, with all kinds of caveats and shortcomings. If that becomes the dominant system in the United States, Canada and British Columbia will inevitably join into that system, you know, warts and all. I don't think a carbon tax needs to be necessarily in opposition to a cap and trade system. Like, you can still have a carbon tax that essentially acts as a floor on the price of certain emissions. So they can be harmonized in various ways together, and that's something we're interested in looking at down the road. But yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. BC's also signed on to this thing called the Western Climate Initiative. And, you know, politically, that's looking like it's simply not going to happen, even though there was, you know, a lot of negotiations, and ostensibly it was to sort of get up and running by 2012. You know, politically, it's just not on as far as the legislatures, the state legislatures in the U.S. go.
And then can economics really address environmental issues in the way that it needs to? And also, can you talk about with that, the Progressive Economics Forum, and how that has played a role in shaping debate around policy?
Well, I think economics can potentially, you know, make a difference, but the mainstream of it is still, you know, very much in the way I described before. It's not really, it's decontextualized from the environment, as if the economy, you know, is not anchored into the ecosystem. And, you know, there are branches in ecological economics, most notably, that have wrestled with this, to sort of think about the overall economic system as, you know, materials and energy flows that go into the production of stuff and wastes that come out of it, and that, you know, you ultimately need to have the inputs and wastes be within some broader notion of sustainability in the environment, in terms of the Earth's capacity to, you know, produce those inputs and to absorb those wastes. So I think those are important insights. But, you know, by and large, the kind of neoclassical mainstream of the economics profession, you know, works on the assumption that, you know, markets work, and that we don't really need to think about environmental problems, apart from, you know, what they call externalities, that there's a really relatively small scale things that are the exception rather than the rule, and that, you know, all you need is sort of a carbon tax or a price mechanism to adjust that, and then the market will function perfectly again. I think there are other branches of economics that, you know, have sort of dispelled those ideas, even though they still have a lot of currency in the mainstream. So, you know, it's difficult. There's a lot of disagreement among economists in terms of you know, how these things work. There's a lot of inertia in terms of, you know, what, how you get promoted and what gets published in the mainstream journals that that are affecting that. But ultimately, you know, the big picture on this is that, you know, climate change is the single, you know, biggest example of market failure that that humanity has ever seen. And to sort of paraphrase Nicholas Stern, who was the former chief economist of the World Bank and wrote this massive report for the British government a few years ago called the Stern Review.
And then can you touch on the Progressive Economics Forum as well?
Yeah, the Progressive Economics Forum. I'm the current chair, although I'm just on my way out, having served two terms. Is a loose network of economists in Canada who are interested in you know, progressive economics, or what you would call in the academy a heterodox approaches to economics, which include things like institutional approaches, post-Keynesian ecological approaches. So a lot of the non-neoclassical ways of thinking about the economy. And, you know, I'm just actually heading next week to Quebec City for our annual meetings as part of the Canadian Economics Association. And, you know, that's one of the main things we do is to sort of put on panels and introduce, you know, non-mainstream ideas to the broader world of the economists who go to the conference. We also run a student essay contest every year, you know, looking at essays who are from students who are writing about, you know, the limits to markets and alternative approaches. We have a John Kenneth Galbraith Prize in Economics, which is awarded every 2 years, and is just being awarded for the second time this year, and it was won by John Loxley of the University of Manitoba. So we're a fairly small organization, but, you know, we have a website and blog, which I think is interesting, and a lot of kind of prominent progressive economists like Jim Stanford and Andrew Jackson and some others contribute to that on a regular basis, and that, people want to check it out, is progressive-economics.ca.
Okay. And finally, I want to ask you, what can we expect from the Climate Justice Project in the next 6 to 12 months?
We have a lot of interesting research projects that have been underway over the past year. Most of what we've been doing is just sort of kind of incubating and launching new projects by bringing together teams of academics and community partners. We have some research on BC's food system and food security, some work on green jobs, some work on adaptation and community resilience, on transportation, electricity generation, household energy efficiency options, and some other sort of communications-oriented ones around, you know, media perceptions of a coverage of climate issues and public perceptions of climate and climate justice.
Great. Well, lots of great stuff to look forward to.
Indeed.
Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day for this interview.
All right. You're welcome.
And take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, and you're either hearing us live, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at 101.9 on the FM dial, and streaming online from your speakers at CITR.ca, or from the future via our podcasts. Available online as well at CITR.ca. That was Andrew Longhurst in conversation with Mark Lee from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, discussing climate justice and progressive economics. And that's our program from May 24th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. Or you can email news at CITR.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with your username CITRNews. And you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink, and from the entire news team at CITR, thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for Career Fast Track right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And we're going to leave you now with a little bit of World of Science by the band. The band is World of Science with the song After School Special.